Good. Well, I think we should start. And a warm welcome to everyone. My name is Donald Lambie, and I'm the leader of the School of Economic Science. This is the first of a series of lectures entitled A Philosophical Garden. And this evening's lecture is on the first element of the title, namely philosophy. What I hope to convey in this talk is something of what the philosophy of the school is, where it came from, and how it works. Later lectures in the series will demonstrate how that philosophy has flowered in the subjects of economics and law, Renaissance studies, dance, art, and music. So, firstly, what the philosophy is. The main ideas in the school's philosophy are based on what is called Advaita philosophy. The word Advaita is a Sanskrit word, and it means universal, devoid of duality. At the heart of this is the idea that the creation is really only the expression of one consciousness, which may be variously described as essence, self, or absolute. Although the form of things differ infinitely, the idea is that there is an underlying unity in the whole of creation. An analogy given to explain this is of a lump of gold, which can be made into countless different forms, such as rings, ornaments, or what have you, but the basic substance of gold remains unaltered. In the same way as the various rings and ornaments are all nothing but gold, the whole creation, including all the people and creatures in it, are expressions of the same essence. Some of you may have seen the posters, "We Are Londoners," where the words "we" and "are" and the letters O-N-E in Londoners are highlighted in red. So the highlight reads, "We are one." Now, I don't say anything about the politics which might lie behind the poster, but the basic message is one to which we in the school would certainly adhere. Except we would say that the principle applies not just to Londoners, but to everyone. And I hope during the course of this lecture this evening to explain a little bit more about that. Now, it will be, I think, helpful to give a little historical background about the Advaita philosophy and how the school has come to it. This involves speaking firstly about a man called Shankara, who was born in the 8th century in India, as well as a more recent exponent called Shantananda Saraswati, who died fairly recently in 1997. As far as Shankara is concerned, who, as I say, lived in the 8th or beginning of the 9th century in India, he is described as having been born at a time when, in India, morality was sinking, there was disrespect for law, the prevailing philosophic ideas were nihilistic in nature, and there was much injustice and confusion in the society. It is said that within his short life of 32 years, he helped to change this situation very much for the better. He wrote extensive commentaries on the great philosophical works of India, and he composed his own philosophic treatise. He also wrote devotional works to inspire and nourish that aspect of human nature. Overall, he is generally regarded as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, philosophers produced by India within recorded history. In the same way that Plato is regarded as the towering figure of Western philosophy, whether people agree with his ideas or not, Shankara is regarded as the towering figure in Eastern philosophy, in particular Indian philosophy. Now, before moving on, there's one point of considerable importance here. Shankara made no claim that the philosophy belonged to him. He didn't say, "This is my knowledge." He only endeavoured to restate what he regarded as the perennial philosophy. And in the same way, we in the school make no claim to philosophy. The attempt is to present ideas as simply and as clearly as possible, but they do not originate with us, nor do they belong to us. We in the school would say that wisdom belongs to no individual or groups of individuals, that it in reality is the birthright of everyone. Now, Shankara established four centres in India to continue to teach and uphold the Advaita tradition, and these continue in existence today. The School of Economic Science came into contact with one such teacher in 1965, a Shankaracharya, as they are called. The word Acharya means teacher. This man was called Shantananda Saraswati, and between 1965 and 1993, he and the former leader of the school, Leon McLaren, met on a regular basis. The conversations, which took the form of Mr. Leon McLaren asking questions and Sri Shantananda Saraswati's answers to those questions, were all recorded and translated during that period by the same translator, the one person who's still alive, a Mr. S.M. Jaiswal. The important thing that we have found about all this is that it has been an exposition of an ancient philosophy tailored towards people living in the West, in the world, as we have it today. Shankara took an extremely intellectual approach, and his writings referred extensively to the ideas and the philosophies that were current in his day. If one is not familiar with those philosophies, his works can at times seem rather difficult. Shantananda Saraswati put matters in a simple and straightforward fashion, and as well as appealing to the intellect, he also appealed to the devotional and active aspects of human nature. Questions and answers covered almost every aspect of human life, and how these can be helped by the light of philosophy. These included such basic matters as how best to work, the application of attention, the conservation and increase of the amount of energy one has, as well as practical advice for artists, lawyers, teachers, parents, doctors, to name but a few. And these were questions and answers that arose out of the work and practice of students in the school, and in that sense they were intensely real. They weren't just abstract speculations. Now, it should be said at this juncture that India is not the only source of the school's teaching, by any means. We do very much seek to learn about and to teach the philosophic and cultural traditions of the West and how these have had an effect and continue to have an effect on our society and our way of living. the marriage of the Eastern philosophy and the study of the Western philosophic and cultural traditions has given rise to the philosophical garden which this series of lectures will seek to illustrate. The thing, of course, about a nice garden is that there are many different plants. None of them are the same necessarily, but they all complement each other. And if I can illustrate this perhaps from my own experience, when I came to the school, I was an averagely educated 17-year-old. And I found myself introduced to spiritual and intellectual riches that I had no idea existed. As well as the philosophy that I'm speaking about, I was introduced to the great artists of the Renaissance, principles of architecture, a realm of music that was certainly not the staple diet of 17-year-olds where I was at school, the principles of the common law, to ideas of economic justice, to the teachings of great figures such as Plato, Hermes Trismegistus, Socrates, and so on. I also came across the Sanskrit language, which taught me more about the underlying principles of the English language than I had ever had any idea about. These were some of the spiritual fruits that I found, and the hope is that as many people as possible will continue to come to the school and to enjoy this philosophical garden. Now, I should say a little bit about the Advaita philosophy itself. The exposition given by Shantananda Saraswati was a much broader exposition than one would find in an academic textbook. And really one could come at this in a number of different ways. But for tonight's purposes, I'm going to take a single statement by Shankara, which encapsulates the basic concept. He said, "The Brahman exists. The world is an illusion. There is no difference between the individual soul and the Brahman." Now, all of this requires, I think, some explanation. The word Brahman is again a Sanskrit word meaning universal soul, with a root that refers to expansion or increase. The universal soul is what we might call God. Generally, however, in the school, we tend to translate the word not as God, but as absolute. This isn't because we have anything against God or the word, but nevertheless, the word God tends to be sometimes pretty loaded. Who's God? What sort of God? Do I believe in God at all? These are some of the ideas that can go with the word. And by using the word absolute, it is perhaps sometimes helpful for people to be free from such preset ideas. Secondly, the word absolute itself is illuminating. Really, it has a double meaning. It means infinite, unqualified, unlimited. But it also means to set free. So we talk about being absolved or receiving absolution. So all of this is contained in the word absolute. And so we would tend to translate Shankara's statement, or the first part of it, as the absolute exists. I'd like to say a little more about the meaning of increasing or expanding, which is contained in the original word Brahma. It's very common for the mind to like to put things into well-defined pigeonholes, to get everything nicely sorted out. For example, at the beginning of the 20th century, young people were told, there's no point in studying science, because very soon all there is to know about science will be known. Now, of course, in the 100 years which have elapsed, the advances in scientific knowledge have been prodigious. Even just in terms of the universe in which we live, the high-powered telescopes keep discovering new galaxies, and the numbers are staggering. And so to say 100 years ago that nothing more remained to be discovered certainly turned out to be false. In philosophic terms, like some of the scientists 100 years ago, some people like to say that this knowledge or this teaching is complete. There's no more to be known. There's no more to be discovered. No more to be understood. And by saying that, an artificial limit is put on knowledge. There is always something more to be discovered. There are always fresh insights to be gained. And we would say that the human spirit should not be confined by any such artificial limit. So the words Brahman and Absolute are good words because they convey some of these notions. So Shankara says the Absolute exists. And to take an analogy, it is a bit like the sun shining on water, maybe the water of an ocean or the water of a lake, and you can see millions of glimmering lights. Sometimes even the reflection is too strong for the eyes to look at directly. But all those dazzling lights obviously only exist because the sun exists. In the analogy, the sun represents the Absolute, and the dazzling lights represent all the different people, beings, and aspects of the creation. They couldn't shine were it not for the light of the sun. Sometimes people say, beyond the creation there is nothing. There is a void. Others might say that whilst God did create the universe, he has subsequently died, and so there is, at this stage, nothing beyond the universe. Philosophically, we would not accept any of those ideas. It would be rather like saying, the light reflects in the water, but there is no sun. Advaita philosophy says that the Absolute is full of vitality, that it gives life to everything. Now, this isn't exclusively an Indian idea, by no means at all. Plato spoke in similar terms. For example, he said that all the beauty of the creation only exists because of an absolute beauty. He said the beauty of the creation is just a reflection of that beauty. In the Symposium, this is how he described it. He who has been instructed thus far, he said, in the things of love, and who has learned to see the beautiful in due order and succession. When he comes towards the end, we'll suddenly perceive a nature of wondrous beauty, a nature which in the first place is everlasting, knowing not birth or decay, growth. Secondly, is not fair in one point of view or foul in another, but is beauty absolute, existing within itself, simple and everlasting, which is imparted to the ever-growing and perishing beauties of all other beautiful things, without itself suffering diminution or increase or any change. In the same way, according to Advaita philosophy, there is an absolute existence by virtue of which everything is given life. This absolute existence is intangible and invisible, but is the basis or the substratum of all existence. And so this is the first limb of Shankara's statement, the absolute exists. The next part of his statement is that the world is an illusion. This is a difficult, indeed sometimes an impossible idea for many people to accept. If someone comes along and punches you on the nose, it's very hard to believe this is an illusion. However, what Shantananda Saraswati said is that the world is a play, a drama. And somehow this is perhaps much easier for us to accept and to understand. Indeed, in the West we've already been told this by Shakespeare, who said, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players." So this is the statement, the world is an illusion, or the world is a play, a drama. But there's a bit more to it than that. The play has to be played nicely. If we come here to the West End, to a theatre, and pay pretty high prices to see a play, we naturally expect that the actors will have learnt their lines, that the director will have done his job well, and that the production will be a good one. This is so whether it is a tragedy, a comedy, or even a farce. The lines have to be delivered perfectly, the timings have to be exquisitely done, and this is what we expect. So this is the first proposition by Advaita philosophy about the play of creation, or the play of life, that it has to be well played. If one is a brother, a sister, a friend, a colleague, an employer or an employee, or a dentist or a carpenter, or whatever else, all of these parts should be well played. That means knowing how to play the part and playing it in such a way that the love which is inherent in that part is made manifest. The second proposition about the play is this, that it is subject to rules. These we call the laws of nature. For example, we speak about people acting humanely or inhumanely. We act humanely when we act in accordance with the laws for humanity. One expression of these natural laws for humanity is found in an old Vedic text. Patience, forgiveness, self-control, not stealing, purification, mastery over sense organs, spiritual intellect, spiritual knowledge, truth, and lack of anger. In the Christian tradition, there is the commandment to love your neighbour as yourself. Now, we could spend a long time examining each of these in detail. But it's perhaps easy enough to see that where people do act in accordance with these laws, the result will be good for all. And when they do not act in accordance with these laws, the result will be bad for all. Such laws don't relate just to physical or worldly things. They are essentially spiritual in nature. So this is the second point about the play of life that we say, that it is subject to laws. The skill or the art comes in applying these laws to the everyday circumstances of life in an intelligent manner. The third point that we say about the play is that it is intended to be enjoyable. Now, that may sound an odd thing to say when we see so much suffering and deprivation in the world. But perhaps somehow that is the consequence of the natural laws being ignored or misapplied. That was certainly the view of Henry George, who was an American who lived in the 19th century. In school, we owe much of our ideas about economics to Henry George. When he was a young man, he went to New York, and he was struck on the one hand by the great wealth, and on the other hand by the terrible poverty. He was a religious man, and he thought, God cannot have intended this to be so. He thought it must be the result of man's ignorance and greed. If we could discover and live by what God intended, then everyone would benefit. This was the notion that he had. And he spent the whole of his life in pursuit of that and trying to persuade others into the same view. He wrote a famous book called Progress and Poverty, and he didn't accept that anyone should be predestined to a miserable and impoverished existence. And in the same way, we in school would say that no one should be predestined to such a fate. Considering this nature of happiness or bliss in the creation in another way, there are many, many cases where people have found themselves in what we would perhaps usually say to be difficult or even terrible or deprived circumstances. And despite this, something in human nature rises up and does experience the bliss in the creation. There's a very well-known example, but nevertheless a beautiful example, of Helen Keller, who was a remarkable woman who was both blind and deaf. And she described the connection she made with this bliss in the following way. She said, "We walked down the path to a well house, attracted by the fragrance of the honeysuckle with which it was covered. Someone was drawing water, and my teacher placed my hand under the spout. As the cool stream gushed over one hand, she spelled into the other hand the word water, first slowly, then rapidly. I stood still. My whole attention was fixed upon the motion of the fingers. Suddenly, I felt a misty consciousness, as of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought. And somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew that the word water meant the wonderful, cool something that was flowing over my hand. That living word awakened my soul, gave it light, hope, joy, set it free. There were barriers still, it is true, but barriers that could in the course of time be swept away. I left the well house eager to learn. Everything had a name, and each name gave birth to a new thought. As we returned to the house, every object which I touched seemed to quiver with life. So these are three propositions about the play. It is to be played nicely, it is subject to the laws of nature, and it is intended to be enjoyable. How does philosophy help this to come about? Shantananda Saraswati said one thing that Shakespeare didn't say. He said that the self, the true self, is the witness of the play. Most of the problems we experience come with identifying with one particular part of the play. Then the real perspective is lost. Then it is so easy to become completely involved with the play and to lose one's freedom. For example, in the space of a few minutes, a person may find himself playing several different parts, even apparently contradictory parts. Someone may be a husband, then a father, then a son, then a brother, then a friend, all in a few moments' time. If one was to identify totally with each of these parts, the result would be very confusing. But behind all these parts, he is himself. According to the philosophy, this self is like the witness of the play, rather than a player in the play. Philosophy acts as a reminder of this and helps us to regain a perspective which in turn helps both us and others to enjoy the play without harm to anyone. So all this is about the play. This is the second limb of Shankara's statement, the world is a play, the world is illusion. The third aspect of his statement is that there is no difference between the self, the individual soul that is, and the absolute soul. This, in a way, is the key piece of Advaita philosophy. There is no difference between human consciousness and universal consciousness. Whatever we may think about ourselves, our real essence is absolute in nature and unlimited. Moreover, this applies to everyone, It is not just one person whose nature is absolute and unlimited, but it is the same for us all. Now, there is an important corollary to this. According to this philosophy, it is not the case that only some will be saved and others will not be. Anyone and everyone is capable of appreciating the absolute nature. That nature is described as true, conscious, and happy. This is embodied in the story of the prodigal son, who received his inheritance from his father, who then went and wasted it in riotous living, and in the end he remembered his previous condition and embarked upon the journey to return to his father. Anyone can do that. No one is precluded. It is not necessary to be part of any particular religion or creed. The knowledge that there is no difference between the individual soul and the absolute is extraordinarily liberating. As often as not, we have a whole series of limitations about ourselves. I can do this, but I can't do that. We perhaps do not often think of ourselves as having an absolute nature. But this is the really important truth about everyone. Going back to the analogy of a lump of gold and various objects being fashioned out of it, we can lose sight of the gold because of all the names and forms. But in reality, we are all gold. Whenever a person's real nature expresses itself, this is what we see. It may be in the form of love, patience, kindness, skill, brilliance, intelligence, or anything. This is the gold showing itself. The question, of course, arises, how is this to be done? It's all very well to talk in these terms, but it has to be practical. The feeling of difference or separation or isolation is caused by what is called in Advaita upadhi, or qualifications. A person may think he is a van driver, a householder, a monk, a priest, or whatever. These identifications cause a limit, and that limit in turn causes separation. One forgets the absolute nature and assumes a transient, limited identity. The word upadhi itself means a substitute. It can mean a phantom, a disguise. We can go about disguised as a teacher or an academic or a bus driver or whatever we like. No doubt we can conjure up dozens of such qualifications that normally circumscribe our identity. There's a story about the man who thought he was Napoleon. And he went to a sage and he announced that he was Napoleon and that he was having difficulty with his generals. They weren't being obedient to his will and they weren't winning enough battles. Well, the sage gave him some advice about how he should speak to his generals and what he should tell them to do, and the man went away again. A month later, he came back and he was delighted. He said to the sage that he'd followed his advice and the generals were now compliant and successful in battle. But, he said, he had another problem. Josephine, he said, was being difficult. Things were troublesome at home. So the sage gave him some more advice and told him how he should speak to Josephine and what he should do, and the man went away again. And a month later he returned, and again he was delighted. He He said relations had been restored and that life with Josephine was once more one of domestic bliss. He was about to present another problem when the sage grabbed him by the lapels and said, "You are not Napoleon." Now this, of course, is a ridiculous identification. But, one way or another, this is the kind of thing that people do. It may not be quite as ridiculous as thinking I am Napoleon, but nevertheless, it is believing in oneself as a separate, limited identity. Philosophy offers two ways of addressing such a mistake. One is based on knowledge and reason, and the other is in the experience of a greater depth of being. These two go hand in hand, but it's necessary to consider them in turn. So first, then, knowledge. There can be knowledge of anything, how to play poker, or how to rob a bank. But that's not the kind of knowledge that here in the school we are interested in. We're interested in a particular kind of knowledge, which we might call wisdom. In the first night of philosophy, wisdom is described as that knowledge which allows life to be lived truly and happily. Now you could say there are two sources of wisdom. One comes from the great teachers of humanity. I've referred to two, to Shankara and to Shantananda Saraswati. And many people in the school have found their wisdom to be profound. Without some external source, it would be so easy to take a wrong turning. The external source is like having a map to guide one on the way. The second source of wisdom is within oneself. It isn't just enough to rely upon someone else. One has to discover for oneself and gain access to one's own wisdom. These two, the external and the internal, are not in conflict. Indeed, quite the opposite is the case. When they come together, the result is excellent. So perhaps to take an example. Shantananda Saraswati said, "My door is always open to anyone, known or unknown, Eastern or Western, irrespective of his upbringing or culture, because in fact we all come from the same stock." These in fact were his opening words to the school in 1965, and we endeavour to make those words practical. So in meeting another person, the question is the door really open? Is the heart open? Is the mind open to that person? As often as not, there is a whole raft of preset or ideas or judgments, such as, "I like him, I don't like him, he is clever, he is stupid, he is better or worse than me," or something of this kind. Or we may just be tired, or fed up, or bored, or angry, or anything. But any of these things mean that the mind and the heart are not really open. They may be partially open, or indeed they may be completely closed. But to keep them completely open requires constant practice. not really just day-to-day practice, but minute-to-minute practice. And likewise, to remember and to recognize that we all come from the same stock. This also calls for continuous practice. Now, when this is known or appreciated, the result is sometimes astonishing. One example comes from a lady in South Africa. She's a reasonably elderly lady, and on this occasion she was driving her car alone in Johannesburg, which can be a dangerous thing to do. And she stopped at some traffic lights, and an armed robber jumped into her car. And he demanded that she drive on, which she did. And in due course, they stopped, and he demanded her money. Well, of course, she had no choice but to hand over whatever she had. But at the same time, she delivered a tirade. She said to him, "This is dreadful behavior. This is criminal, it's antisocial, it's ungentlemanly, everything about it is wrong." So she really let him have it. But the important thing is that, as she described afterwards, in doing so, she didn't lose sight of the fact that he was not separate from herself. She didn't entertain the idea of other, despite the rather dramatic circumstances. She recognized the unity, and something in him must have recognized the unity, because before he got out of the car, he said to her, "That's an extremely dangerous set of traffic lights that you stopped at. Please don't stop there again, madam. You ought to be more careful." So this is an example of how the knowledge can work. Now, it's a great help to have a group of people and for them to be asked to practice something with an open mind, and then later to say what they have discovered from that practice. And what we find is that sometimes for one person, perhaps nothing much is lit up, but for another person, a great deal is lit up. And when that is shared, it is beneficial for everyone. Knowledge, when heard, is just information. When it is practiced, it can turn into real understanding. And this has been the experience of many people in the school. So this is the first way in which the mistake of believing oneself to be a limited, separate identity can be addressed, by the application and practice of knowledge. The second way in which this mistake can be addressed is through the experience of a deeper level of being. When the mind is filled with hundreds of different ideas, all jostling for position, the result, not unnaturally, is confusing. One gets confused about who one really is and what one is supposed to be doing. When the mind becomes still, that confusion isn't there. Then it is possible to discover oneself. Earlier on, I used the analogy of gold and objects made out of gold. Now, to take that analogy in a different way, and that is of mining gold. Beneath the surface, there are rich seams of gold. But those seams have to be excavated. The deeper the stillness, the greater the capacity to be still, to be silent, the greater the capacity to excavate there is. Then we discover the rich seams of gold that lie within us. On the first night in the course of philosophy that we introduce, there is a simple practice given of being still and connecting with the senses. And students are invited to practice this two or three times a day for a couple of minutes each time. And the result can be astonishing, because almost straight away there is a connection with a deeper sense of being. Later on, the practice of meditation is introduced, and this has the same principle, but even more effective. Meditation is beneficial for everyone. One lady said that when she gets cross and irritable at home, her children ask her, or speak to her and say, "Mother, it's time you sit down to meditate." They recognize very clearly that their mother is an altogether more agreeable person when she meditates and is peaceful. Another example I heard just the other day was of a man who had had surgery, and the surgery had nearly gone badly wrong, and it had nearly had fatal results. He then was in the situation of having to have another operation, quite a difficult operation on his spine, but because of the first operation, he was unwilling to have a general anaesthetic. So he spoke to the surgeon and said that he was only prepared to have a local anaesthetic, and the surgeon was rather aghast. He said, "Well, this is never done. The operation will last an hour and a half, and it's always done under a general anaesthetic." And the man said, "Well, there's no difficulty. I can easily last an hour and a half because I meditate." Well, in the end, the surgeon was convinced, and the operation took place. And afterwards, the man said that the experience was extraordinary. He said he lay in the operating theatre and he chatted to the anaesthetist about her children, and sometimes he turned his mind to the meditation, but he found a complete absence of fear and a total trust and confidence in all that was happening. And this he ascribed completely to the meditation. And not only did he find the experience surprising, but the surgeon also, because he said this was completely against, really, generally accepted medical practice, and what had happened it represented an advance on medical practice, and that he would be reporting the operation to the relevant medical society. So these two factors, knowledge and being, come together. Knowledge helps to undo confusion and clear the way for a deeper experience of oneself. This in turn allows a person to see with much greater clarity and understanding. So these are some of the basic ideas about the philosophy and how it is approached in the school. As was said earlier, the Advaita philosophy is most extensive, and one could have come at it in a number of different ways. But we've examined a little bit Shankara's statement, the absolute exists, the world is a play, and there is no difference between the individual self and the universal self. So this is the summary of the philosophy. The title of this series of lectures is The Philosophical Garden. The knowledge which I've spoken about has been applied in different fields to bring light to various subjects. In the lectures to come, something will be said about the natural laws of economics. This is not a dry subject, but one which has profound implications for every human being. We believe if the right laws are followed, everyone can experience freedom and prosperity. There will be a lecture on Renaissance studies. The word Renaissance literally means rebirth. And the lecture will be about how that rebirth has taken place in the past and how it may take place in the future. Then we will come to the subject of dance. The idea here is that in every aspect of life there is a dance. And the idea is to manifest the rhythm of the eternal dance. And the lecture will explain how this has been approached by students in the school. Then there will be lectures on music and art, both of which have the capacity to melt the heart. Quite a lot of time has been spent in studying these subjects, and those who present these lectures will take pleasure in sharing as much as possible of what has been discovered. These are some of the flowers in the philosophical garden. Beautiful flowers need a lot of care, and these flowers are no exception. But they are what makes human life worth living. Behind all these flowers is philosophy. There is no limit to the flowers that may grow in this garden, and we welcome all potential gardeners. Now, there's one final matter I would conclude with. We don't want this philosophical garden to be enjoyed only by people who attend this school. The garden is for everyone. The quotation that I gave earlier, that we are all from the same stock, whether Eastern or Western, regardless of upbringing or culture, is one which I believe is of utmost importance to the world as a whole. We live in a time where there are many disruptive elements, and it can sometimes seem like nothing but conflict and trouble. I believe the message of Advaita philosophy could be of enormous value to the world. It satisfies both the spiritual and practical aspects of human life. It speaks of the universality of the human spirit, the unity of the human family, and it shows how in practical terms the appreciation of these things may grow and manifest. Advaita philosophy is like a drop of honey being added to a glass of milk. It doesn't alter the milk except to make it sweeter. In the same way, philosophy does not demand that a Christian ceases to be a Christian, that a Hindu ceases to be a Hindu, that an Englishman ceases to be an Englishman, or what have you. It only helps to bring the best out of everyone. And the best is always very good indeed. The best is the gold. The problems that the world faces are essentially philosophic problems. And if the problems are philosophic, the solutions are philosophic. I believe that this philosophy holds a key to these problems. And for that reason, I commend it to you. So this is the philosophy, where it comes from, how it works, what it is.